classic cast. We have Rita Moreno from Broadway and screen, starring in the Lily Tomlin role. We have Rachel Dennison, who is Dolly Parton's younger sister, who's about 21 years old and looks like a younger version of Dolly. She also sings. Playing
D-I-S-O-N.
We have Jeffrey Tambor playing the role of Franklin Hart Jr., boss you love to hate. Yeah, that's true. That's right. We have Gene Marsh from Upstairs Downstairs playing the role of Roz, the office spy. And Valerie Curtin playing the role that Jane played in the film, who you may remember from Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, and who is a screenwriter in her own, who co-wrote And Justice for All. Yes.
How closely involved would you be with that?
No, we've been pretty closely involved. We have a relationship at ABC, and they gave us an order for 4 episodes, and we're very involved in all the overseeing the writing for those. Actually, there are 8 scripts. We're shooting 4 so far, and definitely on the casting of it, and we will stay involved in the writing. It appears they haven't given us an air date yet, but it appears, given what's happening on most of these networks, that we will be a mid-season replacement.
How do you select some of the shows that you've been kind of involved with? Is it a joint effort? Do you study it?
Well, in terms of the initial coming up of the subject, that can be either one of us can come up with that. Generally, then I do some preliminary research, and we'll begin to kick around the idea of a story, and then bring in a screenwriter and do some really intensive research behind it before the actual writing begins.
Following up on that, with the exception of On Golden Pond, the scripts have been original. Does that represent a priority on your part?
It really represents an impatience with waiting for good scripts to come in. Because I think we'd still be waiting. There are very few good scripts written today, and it is people underestimate how difficult it is to get a good screenplay written. It's probably the closest thing to haiku poetry that I can imagine, because the form is so rigid, and it requires a really particular kind of talent and style. People who just look at most movies up there and say, "Oh well, I can do better than that," usually find out that they can't.
Is it simplistic to ask if you can find a reason for this dearth of script writing? Is it because so many people end up writing for television and maybe don't pay attention to the subtleties and possibilities of film?
No, I think there are a number of reasons. One of the big ones is that, in the past, in the so-called golden era, writers were under contract, and they generally were in the writer's building and had to come in every day. And what you had was a kind of passing on of the craft of screenwriting among, the best of the writers that were around. These days, screenwriters, if anything, they're maybe in film school for a year or two or three, and they're not studying screenwriting the whole time, if they're studying it at all. And they go off on their own, totally alone, to try and construct something. And once the first time something sells, they don't want to talk to anybody again about how to perfect their craft. And it's something that really has to be worked on over a long period of time with people who know something about it.
And speaking of that golden age, you had people like Ben Hecht, who had a reputation as being a script doctor.
Right.
Could be called into a problematic situation. Does that kind of script doctor exist today?
Oh, very definitely it does. I mean, virtually every story that we've been involved with the exception of Ernest Thompson's adaptation of his own play and On Golden Pond, has had more than one writer. So whether it's been a fast doctoring or whether it's been a complete rewrite job, it often happens that the old saw that a screenplay isn't written, it's rewritten, really holds true for us.
How much does Jane Fonda write?
None.
You had something to do with the last film. What was Jane do?
Well, before On Golden, we've
done. On Golden Pond, right?
Yeah, we've done five now.
Yeah, On Golden Pond. Have you softened his character at all?
Softened it?
Well, in the original version that I saw at the Kennedy Center, he was a bigot. He was another Archie Bunker, and I really felt the play was like four episodes of All in the Family, and I didn't like Archie Bunker then. He did get on my nerves because I am sensitive to that. Later, when I saw the mechanic in Baltimore, they had eliminated all the racial references except for one or two, but those themselves were not objectionable per se. Is he the bigot that he originally was in the film, or has you softened him for the film too?
I don't think so. I don't share your view of the original one.
Does he use racial
tags? Only towards Italians and dentists.
Thanks a hell of a lot. But towards Jews, you see, and you change it from Jews to Italians.
No, it was always in there in the beginning of that.
In the beginning, it was Jews and Italians and Puerto Ricans and just about everything. He hated everybody. Then in the second version I saw, there was nothing about Italian, but it was about the Jews. Now you've done a film, and it's not about the Jews, it's about the Italians.
Right. Well, we had a Jewish director.
Yeah, that's it always happens.
But I don't share that. I don't think he was a bigot. I think he lived in a confined area up there in New England, and they never saw anybody else. And I don't think he was, mean about them. I just think he discarded them because he didn't know what they were like.
Yeah, I think he used it as a defense. I don't think he was. Yeah. I don't think he was a bigot.
You can pardon with his that. You know,
no, I mean he used it as a way of distancing himself emotionally.
Well, why do you suppose it is that whenever, say, Jews are used as an example of projected bigotry on stage, many of these kinds of film, it's always changed to the Italians or something. For instance, they did that with Sleuth. It's on stage, there were about two references to Italians. Then it became a film, but 30 references to Italians and two to Jews. And you're doing it here too. Is somebody protecting himself?
It's definitely a conspiracy. In this case, we didn't spare dentists or Italians, and the dropping of the one Jewish reference that there is in the play only came about because the scene was cut down. Sounds like you're a bit of a bigot.
No. I'm Italian, and I'm sensitive to all that, and it always happens. And on occasion, when the Italian can be presented in a favorable light, such as in Same Time Next Year, they change it to an Irish girl for the movie. There does seem to be some kind of, I may be overly sensitive, but there is. You're joking when you say conspiracy.
Well, look into that. Maybe we should do a movie about Italian.
I think you've done them. You did The Godfather and Godfather.
I didn't. I wish I had done that one, though. I didn't do that one, though.
With On Golden Pond, do you think that is going to be the last appearance of Fonda will be able to make? Is he going to be able to work?
I don't know. I don't want to predict that man. He's one of the strongest people that I've ever met. Although he's not a well man right now, it's really impossible to say. He's come back so many times.
For all, Lionel Barrymore had quite a career in a wheelchair.
Yeah,
well, there's a movie that Jane Fonda was projecting about the Revolutionary War. Were you involved with that too?
Yes, that was one of our early projects that. The problem with that film is that I think that it's missed its time. We were trying to prepare it in time for the bicentennial. And so not only that, but I think the cost of that film is probably prohibitive in today's market.
Are you able to explain why it is that Revolutionary War subjects are so infrequently handled in film? Why not?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. One is that studio executives tend to look at it and say, well, there's never been a picture about the Revolutionary War that's made money. Therefore, it must be poison at the box office. So we better not make one.
Because I've heard that Peter Weir from Australia may be working on a Revolutionary War subject. It seems odd we'd end up going to Australia to have something like that done.
Well, given the conventional wisdom at most studios, it doesn't surprise me.
Well, why is the Civil War so popular and that not?
Also,
Civil
I guess
romantic it's somehow in the revolution.
It's because also because the you know, at this point, the Revolutionary War figures are so they've become larger than life, and not that they're too far back in time, because it's possible, I think, to do a good film about any age. But it's very hard to do a film at least about well-known figures of the Revolutionary War and have and cloak them with less than halos. You know, if you go back to the diaries and the newspapers of the time, you know, you actually find a very, very different story than the one you usually find in textbooks. And I think it would make, there's a lot of material there for a fascinating movie or movies, but yes, and a few other people.
You're rather young, right? 34, 35? Has that youth ever constituted a detriment in your view? Have people sometimes not taken you seriously because they've seen you as still a fairly young person to be involved in the production end of films?
Yes, but then I punch them out. No. It hasn't. I mean, if you know, you have to understand there's at least a 1-2 punch, though, that we come in with. One is a good story, I hope, and the second has been Jane Fonda as an actress. So
and a good
it's like
record.
Chris Christopherson says, you know, you come up with a $500 million, they'll take you seriously. You come in with those two elements, and they take me seriously so far. And I'm getting older.
Okay, now, we mentioned the fact that you have a track record behind you. Nonetheless, there is that dictum that one is only as good as his last film. So is there any truth in this? In other words, does the relative success of something like Rollover have an influence on future projects that you're able to do?
Yeah, certainly to some extent. This is a very competitive business. But for a producer, it's somewhat different than it is for a director or an actor. I don't know, I suppose there's good and bad parts to it. I mean, if an actor or an actress does well, or a director does well in a film, they're showered with offers. Producer does well in a film, it's back to square one. Nobody's coming at you with offers. A producer has to come up with it and put it together. And every time is like building a new prototype. You're starting from scratch. Just because you did something well the last time, told a story well, came up with a good subject matter, cast, director, etc., doesn't mean that you will the next time. You know, with an actor or director, they might be able to use the experience in the last one to perfect their craft a little more. So it's, you could have a failure, but if you came back with a good story and a good cast or director, you know, I don't know, maybe it's not as bad, but it's not as easy either. Because you can, in my particular case, every film has been successful in terms of the box office. That has not made it any easier for me at all, every time we go out, fortunately.
I was going to say, at least that means that no one is permitted to rest on laurels. There's still that competitive edge there.
Yeah, and there's a try to pick films that are going to be a challenge anyway, because that's what makes it interesting for me.
What is next?
What's next? Well, yeah, we have two or three things that could be. First, we do have the 9-to-5 television series, which is in production now. Secondly, there is an adaptation of a novel that Jane will not be in, called Jack the Bear. It's being written right now by Larry D. Cohen, who, if you've seen the movie Ghost, no, Larry D. Cohen, Ghost Story,
yes.
And Carrie. We also are developing a movie for television that will involve Jane called The Dollmaker, a three-hour movie for television, and it will involve her on TV in a dramatic role for the first time. What else, Wendy? This is Wendy Lazar, who's the associate producer of Rollover and an IPC-er.
What is Jack the Bear? Is that a political film at all?
Jack the Bear?
Yeah.
Maybe it is in the same sort of sense that On Golden Pond is, that it's about social relationships, family relationships. I don't know, my sort of one-line synopsis of it is it's like The Graduate 20 years later. It's somebody who came out of the 1960s and who has developed a certain value system and ideals and now finds himself in the 1980s having to raise two kids and try to fit into a society and find a way of working that can be consistent with his values, and then finds that in fact he's got to grow up.
I detect in everything you're saying an aversion to hardware type films, special effects films, fantasies, the kinds of things that have represented good box office. Relationships seem to be much more important in your mind as your own film.
Yeah, in some sense, I mean, it's sort of old-fashioned in a way, but I think the story is the really important part. The story, the story, the story. It's got to have a solid three acts, good character development, well-structured. You know, if you don't start there, it's not going to show up on the screen. But as far as having an aversion to special effects, let me tell you that creating a nuclear power plant for the China Syndrome was many special effects. That place does not exist except on film. And through the use of miniatures, models, matte photography, shooting at many different locations and piecing them together later, and part of it being built as a set, we created the illusion of a rather large power plant. That was a real exercise for me. Plus, in 9 to 5, we had the three fantasies. It also involved a lot of special effects. However, they're very tough, predictable, and expensive.
Have you ever heard from any of the Disney people as a result of the parody on Snow White?
Oh, no. We clear all that before we shoot it.
Sounds like you'd be doing more and more TV work. Are you going more into that than the theatrical
films? Not more into it than the theatrical films, but we definitely have a commitment to television. And we'll be trying to... We have expanded our staff, first of all, and we are now beginning to develop more things in the television area, but we haven't abandoned feature films at all.
Do you think it's professionally wise for Jane Fonda at this stage in her career to do a television movie? I know there are some actors who do both, but some just do movies because they feel that's where their attraction lies and their strength is, as star attractions lie. And you think that she's given it some thought, I'm sure, but at this stage in her career, do you think it's wise for her to do one?
It's true that the conventional wisdom that exists right now would say, why would anybody who is the who's been the largest female box office draw for 2 years in a row want to go back and do television? However, the way we look at it is that you can complain a lot about television. It is probably the single most important technology in terms of shaping values and opinions, certainly in our country and around the world. So you have to take it seriously, number one. And number two, it's not going to get any better unless talented people get involved in it. And in the early days of television, of live television, you had some of the best writers, directors, and actors perform that are working in feature films today working in television. Well, part of what I hope happens from this is that we can take some of the stigma now off of people who work in feature films from going back and working in television from time to time. And so maybe it'll turn out to be very unwise, but it's worth a risk of trying to see if we can reverse a disturbing trend in one very important industry.
How long do you think the theatrical scene of the movie house will really last? I mean, movies today are being built like very easily converted into stores. I mean, converting Radio City is a little bit more of a job. But I mean, we have 8 6-plexes, 7-plexes, 8-plexes. They just flatten the floor. They'd have a little shopping mall. I mean, it seems like they're, you know, building with no decor, whatever. And do you think that's a, even though we're getting more of them, do you think that's sort of a, on the way out for theatrical release?
I think there will always be a market for theatrical films shown in a theater where people experience them together in a kind of social experience. But probably the variety of films will be narrowed to much more general mass appeal subject matters, or certain highly visual special effects type movies and experiences. I don't share, as I guess a lot of other people do, that the home video market is going to wipe out theaters in the near future. If it has any...
It's awful expensive.
Well, yes, I also think that the technology, that people feel it, until they perfect a television screen that can reproduce the same kind of quality that you can get in the films, it's going to be an important but limited market.
That's something I wanted to follow up. Especially widescreen films are impaired on video. Now, when you are shooting a film, do you or someone on the set, do they have a priority there to keep the visual field to a television size ratio? In other words,
they don't do that, but it is in the we usually use an eyepiece in the viewfinder of the movie camera that has etched into it the television screen format, so that you're trying to make sure that no important action is occurring outside of those parameters. Otherwise, what used to happen is when they transfer these films to
those electronic scans
to television. Well, sometimes you'd have two people talking on opposite ends of a table. When it got to TV, all you saw was the table, and the two people were off screen. So you try and take that into consideration, yes, when you shoot the film.
Which, in a sense, though, means that the widescreen film that we think of with Kurosawa and maybe earlier in the 50s is no longer what it once was. Widescreen film sort of defeats its own purpose if it has to continually look toward television viewing too.
I don't think so. I mean, it there is a way for a good cameraman and director to compose a shot so that you're certainly getting the full effect when you do see it in the theater, but you're not missing very much when it's later shown on television and the field is somewhat shrunken.
You shoot alternate versions of different scenes?
No.
What about the language? Do you change the dialogue for a TV version?
Yes. Yes, you do. In one of two or three ways. Either you can cut to a reaction shot and drop the line altogether. You can have someone mouth the word but just drop the sound out, or you can bleep it.
How does the New York Times get the New York Times? That's
marvelous. I haven't heard from them yet. I'll probably hear from their lawyers.
What do you think about your, although your films really are horror films, the way these two, you know, China Syndrome, I mean, classic
not
horror
all
films.
Of them.
But I mean, there's the monster is a different thing. But maybe,
yes.
Think of this constant output of mindless horror films that just seems to be dominating right now, the Halloweens and the Friday the 13th and so forth. I mean, How long do you think this will go on? Is this just a fad? The man that made Halloween says he's going to make one every year, as long as the money comes rolling in.
Yeah, well, there's always been a market for horror films, that's for sure. I also think it is like every trend and fad. I mean, when there's one successful one, then all of a sudden you see 10 more. Not all of them have been successful, and so I think you'll see a reversing of the trend. But there'll always be a few every year that I think that reach an audience that wants to be scared.
How about message films like Rollover? If that fails, what does that mean in terms of doing another?
I'll probably retire. What does it mean if it fails? It depends on the reason. Oh, God.
No, it's because there's so few American films that have any kind of ambition at all to do anything political.
I don't think the failure of one film will spell the death of films that have something to say. I mean, I think there's a long tradition of that in Hollywood, you know, that goes back to even films that Jane's father made, like Grapes of Wrath, Failsafe, Doctor Strange, right up to today, you know, films like Network, Godfather 1 and 2, Italians notwithstanding.
But do you think you could have sold this film without Jane Fonda?
Yeah, if we'd had Meryl Streep.
Very good. I would have bet you that. If you had Meryl Streep, would that have been the right combination?
Yeah, let's see if there's anybody from Orion here that could. Well, I think this was a darn good combination. I don't even want to think about another one. I mean, after making it, but
Alan Pakula emphasized to us that the star quality is certainly a very important part of this film.
Yes,
you seem to be reaffirming.
Yes, absolutely. The intentions right from the beginning of how to tell this story was to create two kind of mythic characters that are sort of movie characters in the sort of the Hitchcock tradition, but placing them in a background of international intrigue and finance that is very real. And it's the blending of those elements that is very important, and you couldn't do it without major stars. Couldn't do it with unknowns.
What about the title? I mean, I don't think the whole public knows what that means. I didn't until the pictures got going. I mean, I didn't know what the term meant.
Right.
Do you think people are going to say it's rollover? I mean, two words, rollover in bed?
That's okay if they do. It's also the second. They said very similar things about the China Syndrome. We tried to use that. We started a teaser campaign back then of the China Syndrome. It's not about China. In this case, rollover probably has the connotations of rolling over in bed, but as people view the movie, and enough people start viewing the movie, and word of mouth begins to spread on it, they find that there's also another meaning to the term, and that people discover that, I think, is good, fun. People have to work very hard in this movie, and that was also self-conscious. This is the most difficult subject matter that we've ever taken on, and it is the most demanding of the audience. But I think, you know, people sometimes say, well, you think the average moviegoer is going to get it? I think two or three previews have shown us that they do. But a lot of the average moviegoer still says, well, I got it, but I'm not sure if the average moviegoer is going to get it. And I think people are very proud that they do.
Enjoy it without understanding every detail.
Yeah, and you don't have to understand every detail.
They're saying, often said that the average age of the movie goer, the age of the average movie goer is like was 18 to about 34. Now some people are saying, well, it's actually from about 20 because we're all growing old, the median age is.
Yeah.
So it's going up to about 44. I have noticed, I think, at the afternoon screenings that many more older people are coming into the theater. Is the industry aware of this? And or are you still all making films with that
youth audience,
18 to 34 audience in mind?
I think in general, most studio people are not aware of that. On Golden Pond, for instance, was turned down by a number of studios. Maybe after On Golden Pond, they will become more aware of it. But I don't think it is generally accepted yet.
What?
The idea that the older audience is going, not only that they're there, but that they're going to movies.
Excuse me, we're going to have to break you off again. We'll be on.
So soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Very
Thank
cooperative.
You.